I'm Carol Coletta, and this is Smart City. If you think gas is expensive now at the peak of summer driving season, can you imagine gas at $20 a gallon? Forbes staff writer Christopher Steiner has, and it's a future that looks surprisingly rosy if we get ourselves on track. And even in these turbulent economic times, there are people who are thriving. Randall Jones has talked to 100 of them. We'll discover what he learned about money and about life by interviewing the richest man in town. All that plus the latest news from Plan Edison and our City Views commentator Walker Smith coming up on today's Smart City. You're listening to Smart City. I'm Carol Coletta. In the summer of 2008, most Americans found out just how much they were willing to pay for gas. Prices shot up to more than $4 a gallon in some parts of the country, and many Americans responded by driving less, trading in their SUVs, and walking more. My guest, Christopher Steiner, says that the summer of 2008 was just a sample of what's to come. Christopher's new book imagines what the world will look like when a gallon of gas costs $20. Chris, gas prices are confusing to Americans. They go up, then they go way up, and then they come down. You are predicting an inevitable rise and prices as high as $20 per gallon. Why?
$20 per gallon, that's a price that's several decades in the future. But I think it's important to realize that we have just recently gotten to a point where demand can really go way past supply in the oil world. This is a recent phenomenon. Previous to the last several years, when we got into kind of the peak oil era, there was always excess capacity, which held the price down. So now we have 2 billion more people entering the global middle class over the next 30 years. Right now, there's only 1 billion of those people on the globe. So we're going to triple the amount of people who live what we call American-style lives. Those people all are going to use oil. But the amount of oil we pump out of the earth per day is actually going down. It peaked around 87 million barrels per day. It's been going down ever since. That was about 5 years ago. So as that number goes down, albeit slowly, there's a number of people wanting oil and demanding oil and being able to pay for oil is actually going up every day. So it's economics 101. Supply goes down, demand goes up, the price has to go up.
But we're not acting in ways, Chris, that suggest that we believe gas prices are inevitably going to rise.
Well, people typically don't change the way they behave until they're forced to. And clearly, $2.50 for a gallon of gasoline isn't enough to really force behavior changes on a wide scale. Now, when we saw gas at $4 last year in 2008, we definitely saw a tipping point, if you will, for the American public. Last year, Americans drove 100 billion less miles than they did the previous year. We've never had a drop like that. In fact, almost every year before that, going back to 1981, we drove more miles every year.
Tell me how you expect life to change as gas prices rise.
Well, that's what the whole book's about, and it chronicles the different changes that come in at different prices of gasoline. And so I could talk forever on that, but you know, some of the main points here I think are that air travel is going to become a perk, a treat, something that, you know, you can't do like hopping into a cab. I mean, a lot of us travel all over the United States right now like we are hopping in a cab. I mean, you can go to the West Coast for $250, and for a lot of middle and upper middle class Americans, that's really not that much money. And in the future, those flights will be more like $1,000 or more. So they're still going to be out there if you really need to get somewhere quickly, but they're not going to be as available. In addition to air travel, I think the most interesting thing that's going to happen is the reversal of fortune of some of our cities. Cities like Detroit and St. Louis and Pittsburgh, places that have lost more than half of their urban populations over the last 50 years, are going to get them back as people kind of flee the exurbs for places where they can live more densely and get the energy savings that come with living densely.
You say that with rising gas prices, people are going to shift from suburbs to cities. Cities that we don't expect to come back will come back. What are cities going to need to do to accommodate that shift?
Well, basically, to just put a nice shiny maxim on it, cities have to behave in the future, and they will behave more like New York behaves already. Now, certainly, we're not going to see a bunch of mini New Yorks pop up. We have 70,000 people per square mile on Manhattan Island right now. That's the kind of density that you're not going to see anywhere else. That's been building for over 200 years. But when I say live more like New York, I mean, right now, you have 70,000 people per square mile in Manhattan, which is incredible, because of the underlying infrastructure on the island. New York wouldn't exist, it wouldn't work, it wouldn't make any sense without the kind of subway lines and train lines and tunnels that zigzag all across the island. So in the future, places like Dallas, Atlanta, Denver, these places are going to behave more like New York. They're not going to be afraid to spend the money to build things like subway lines, elevated train lines, monorails. They're not going to be afraid to spend the big dollars on those projects because people are going to demand them. People are going to want them. In New York, that demand's already there. New York right now is spending $7 billion to build an East Side Access Tunnel from Queens over to Grand Central Station. And that's just so people coming on commuter trains, on the Long Island commuter trains, don't have to go to Penn Station so they can get off instead at Grand Central and not do the crosstown commute. So that's $7 billion just so people don't have to go crosstown if they get out of the train. That seems very wasteful to someone in Denver or Atlanta because it's really not a big difference. But they do not place the value on mass transit that New Yorkers already do. And in the future, people in those other places will.
What do you think gas prices have to be to spark that kind of big investment you're talking about?
Well, I think, you know, as soon as we start seeing gas prices of $6, $8, $10 per gallon, you're going to see investment in mass transport start off. But I think kind of the point of no return, where the suburbs, not all suburbs certainly, but where the least adaptable and furthest out burbs will be doomed, and where the cities that have collapsed will come back to life, and where that kind of tipping point is at $12 per gallon.
You mentioned earlier we're not going to hop on a plane for $250 and jet to the West Coast. What's the alternative? We're not going to drive, obviously. Gas is not going to be available or too expensive. Are we going to become hyper-local, or are we going to find other ways to get there?
I think in some ways we'll be more local than we used to be, absolutely. But travel will still be an option, especially as high-speed trains start to work their way across and in different parts of America. Because what you're going to see is high-speed train, the demand for them right now is very segmented. There are certain people who want them. Most people don't really care. But that's because air travel is so cheap and driving is so easy. I mean, anything under 500 miles, you just drive. Otherwise, you take a plane. Now, in the future, when most of our airlines start going out of business at $8 per gallon, you're going to start to see the demand for high-speed trains really pick up. And as the price of gas goes up and up, you'll start to see regional networks that have been built in places like the Midwest, the Northeast Corridor, and on the West Coast be connected by nationwide high-speed train lines. So in the future, it'd be possible to get on a train in downtown Chicago at Union Station and get off a train in Midtown Manhattan 7 hours later.
That is the day I am hoping for. When we talk about hyperlocalization, you also have pointed out that rising gas prices will spawn a renaissance of manufacturing in America because we'll need to make goods closer to home, closer to the consumer, so that we reduce transportation costs. Now, today, transportation costs are a very small part of the cost of goods. Again, what do prices have to be to alter something as big and as pervasive as globalization?
Well, globalization is a very powerful force, and certainly it won't be stopped by gas prices of $6 per gallon. But, you know, it's those very small value-added items, the plastic trinkets, the shoes, the clothes, those types of things will actually move first because they're so cheap that at some point the cost of transporting them becomes defeatist to the whole purpose of building them, say, in China or India.
So the cheap goods move back first, you think?
They'll move back first. But certainly things like cars, I mean, you know, obviously we already build a lot of those here anyway. But
we import a lot.
We do. And that kind of stuff will end up back here in the end. But I think the point of no return for the globalization as we know it is $14 per gallon. At that point, the price of moving a container across the Pacific Ocean is going to triple or quadruple from where it's at now. And you'll see a lot of manufacturing slowly come back to the United States.
It's a really interesting scenario, Chris. You speaking of transportation cost and how that factors into the cost of what ends up in our homes, you also predict that even our diets will change. Talk about that.
Well, right now, if you live in Chicago and you go into a local grocery store, be it a Dominick's, which is a Safeway, or a Jewel, which is an Albertsons, you're probably looking at apples from New Zealand in Washington State. Once in a while, you find some random outliers in there, but that's typically what we see almost all year round. And because that's, for some reason, Safeway has figured out that getting a apple in that store in Chicago from New Zealand, because they're dealing with some kind of conglomerate that has massive scale, is cheaper for them than to bring in an apple from Southwest Michigan. Yet Michigan is only 100 miles away, and it's one of the more intense orchard-growing parts of the country. So in the future, we'll see more apples in Chicago and from places like Wisconsin, Michigan, and Western Illinois.
So the eat local, buy local movement you see a good future for.
I do. I mean, right now it's very hard to eat local much more than, say, going to the farmer's market once a week. Because it's just, when you walk in the grocery store, it's just very hard to do. There aren't many local goods on the shelves because it's just not economical. But like I said, this kind of phenomenon will spread to the bigger retailers as time goes on. And I also think that you're going to see produce farming move closer to cities. You'll see a ring of farms for certain types of produce be around metropolitan areas. Now, I think, you know, your commodity type things like grains, wheat, corn, soy, those will still stay out, way out, and no matter where they're at. It doesn't really matter because that stuff's easily shippable on rail. It doesn't perish very easily. It's the close-in stuff where right now we're bringing a lot of our produce in Chicago from Mexico and California, and some of it from even further away. But in the future, a lot of that produce will be grown closer to home.
Somebody wins and somebody loses in any scenario, any economic scenario. And so in the scenario of rising gas prices, who wins? Who loses?
Well, certainly I think people who are in denser areas are going to win. Their property values are going to go up. They'll already find themselves in the right place. Who loses? People who live in the kind of the big box suburbs. And, of course, the big box stores lose too. But getting back to the people who live out there in the exurbs, people are going to decry that fact. And as they should, nobody likes to see people lose their equity in their home. But we've seen this happen before when it happened in inner cities in the 50s and the 60s. People had their equity erased. Now it's just going to happen again, but in reverse. So this is the kind of thing that's happened before. But when we talk about the big box stores, when we talk about Walmart, Walmart's not going to survive in their current form in a future of $12 or $14 gasoline. This is a network with 4,000 stores in America. They have 6,000 global suppliers. 80% of those are in China. So they bring this stuff over on cargo ships very cheaply, unload it in California and Seattle, and then disseminate it across the nation with 7,000 semi-trucks to 4,000 stores. That is a network built purely on cheap gasoline and cheap oil. Without it, it just doesn't work.
There are a lot of people who believe that technology is going to save us, and we really won't have to make these changes. We will continue to live life as we know it, because there will be something that takes the place of oil, and we can simply continue on. Do you not see that as a reasonable scenario?
Well, I agree on one point and disagree in another. I do think technology is going to keep our lives very comfortable, though they will be different. All sorts of technologies are going to sprout out, from the kind of cars we drive, to the kind of solar panels on our roof, to the kind of insulation on our walls. But at the same time, the kind of energy density that we get from oil, that was a one-time gift that we're not going to get again. And I think saying that technology will save us and just ignoring any type of responsibility to change, that's just irresponsible to me. But the beauty, if you want to call it that, in this situation is as the price of gas goes up, it will force change, whether we want to do it or not.
If you were the public policy czar of this country, what changes would you make to anticipate what you believe are these inevitable rise in gas prices?
Well, I mean, this is an easy one. And I think politicians have all sorts of ways of going about this. But the easiest way to do it, and the cheapest way, without building a bunch of other bureaucracies, is to just raise the gas tax. I mean, what if we instituted a $1 tax federally on each gallon of gasoline? Right now, the federal gas tax is only 18.4 cents, which is woefully low for a lot of reasons. And it hasn't been raised since the early 90s when gas was about 90 cents a gallon. So what if we brought in an additional dollar tax, phased in at a quarter at a time, maybe every 6 months? That would go to great lengths, A, to keep more money inside this country rather than sending it abroad, and B, it would help evoke some of these changes quicker than, say, the natural price of gasoline. When we start talking about the amount of gas we use 20 million barrels of oil a day. So working out the gas tax, it amounts to $400 million a day in federal gas tax for that's the extra dollar. That's $140 billion a year. That's real money. That's something you can build with. That's something that would actually help our deficit. In addition to the fact that Americans would change without sending money overseas to people that generally don't like us. Now, Europe has lived with gas prices of three times our prices for more than 20 years, and they live generally comfortably lives. So it can be done. The people who scream about how the whole economy is going to collapse and life as we know it's going to come to an end if gas is $8 or $9, clearly they're wrong if you look at the European model. The Europeans made a bunch of changes that we should have made back in the 70s. They didn't have the luxury that we had in being able to turn up their own oil pumps. Now we no longer have that luxury either. But they made the changes in the 70s. We didn't.
Well, now, I don't disagree with you at all on the value of a gas tax. I think we are shooting ourselves in the foot on this. But is that an appropriate public policy response to rising oil prices? I mean, do rising oil prices that you predict are inevitable eventually take care of this on their own?
Well, they will. But the problem with those is that, again, you have this giant transfer of wealth to people outside our own country, to places that where we can't control much of anything, although we may try in vain. So, I mean, it's just easier. Well, look, we can take our medicine now and be prescient about this and keep more money inside the country to build out the kind of infrastructure we're going to need in the future to overcome high oil prices. Or we can take our medicine later and enrich other countries even more so than they're going to be enriched otherwise.
Do you see any positive signs that we are in fact adjusting to what you see as inevitable?
Well, I mean, if you just look at housing prices in the last year. Now, basically, we've had a giant housing crash over the last year or two. And some of the places hardest hit are those exurban developments. And they're not recovering. Some of the places that have held up best are the more urban spots. And I think right now, you're seeing people in general, this certainly doesn't go for everybody, but there is a desire to kind of live in a place that's walkable, where your kids can walk to school, where you can walk to the train, where you can walk to the grocery store. And some of that is from, say, the boomers whose kids are actually now out of their homes, and they want to get rid of these big exorbitant homes they have, and they want to go back to the city. And I think that movement is kind of almost independent of gas prices right now, but it will form into the momentum of higher gas prices forcing people into the cities.
Do you consider this an apocalyptic vision or something that's good for us in the end?
I think in the end, people are going to be surprised at how well we adapt and how good their lives remain. The whole apocalyptical vision of, say, James Howard Kunstler, who wrote The Long Emergency, which was an important book as it, you know, kind of shed light on the whole problems of peak oil. But, what Kunstler doesn't do is, A, take in the fact that there's still a lot of oil left in the ground, and it's not disappearing overnight. He kind of acted like the pumps are shutting off over the next 10 years, and we're all going to be fighting for the last scraps of bread on the street very soon, so go buy some guns. I don't really see things happening like that. You know, we're still, even if oil production goes down by 15 or 20%, which is a lot, we're still pumping out 70 million barrels of oil a day in the world. That's still a lot of oil. Granted, the price will be much higher because there's more people who want it and there's less oil, but we'll still have it and we'll still be able to function and we'll adjust to the higher price. That's what capitalism is all about. And last time I checked, we are still a capitalist country, but doing things that aren't so capitalist, like putting a tax on the gas, that's the type of thing that could really help us move ahead on energy policy that we really don't have in this country whatsoever right now.
The book is $20 per gallon, How the Inevitable Rise in the Price of Gasoline Will Change Our Lives for the Better. Christopher Steiner, thanks so much for being our guest on Smart City.
Thank you. I really enjoyed it.
And now for the latest news in the world of urban planning and design, we turn to Nate Berg of Plan Edison.
The decline of the housing market, the explosion of foreclosures, and the global economic recession are starting to make the American dream of owning a home look more like the American nightmare. That's how it's turned out for a lot of people who have been lured into unrealistic investments. A recent article from the Wall Street Journal looks at how government policies from the past few decades have placed homeownership high atop the pedestal of economic security. But when home loans started egging the lower middle class towards the underregulated territory of Wild West McMansionism, something was bound to go wrong. And it has, big time. So now, the realities of what's affordable seem to be sinking in. A recent survey from the National Foundation for Credit Counseling found that one-third of respondents didn't think they'd ever be able to afford to buy a home. And more than 40% of former homeowners didn't think they'd ever be able to own a home again. So it seems the age of the ownership society may be starting to die down. And the Obama administration is looking to help make sure it does. Officials announced recently that they were planning to redirect $4.25 billion in stimulus funds to build federally subsidized rental units. An article from the Boston Globe outlines the plan, which is estimated to put tens of thousands of rental units into the pool of available housing. In addition to building new apartments and townhouses, some of the money will be used to purchase and refurbish some of the foreclosed homes that litter American cities. It's part of a shift in ideologies within the cabinet away from the policies of George W. Bush that prioritized home ownership through attractive loan programs. This new focus is being headed by Housing and Urban Development Secretary Sean Donovan, who hopes to revise those policies to clearly determine when home ownership just isn't a realistic option. In addition to investing the $4.25 billion in new properties, another $4 billion will be spent on maintenance and repairs to the existing affordable housing stock. Though the administration is not explicitly against homeownership, its new policies are designed to make sure that the incentives to own a home don't overshadow the inherent risks it has for lower-income people. Given the implosion of the housing market and its tumbling values, avoiding those risks may become the new American dream. For Plan Edison, I'm Nate Berg.
Nate Berg is the assistant editor of PlanEdison.com. Coming up after the break, we'll talk to Randall Jones about the 12 commandments of wealth and other lessons he learned while writing his book, The Richest Man in Town. I'm Carol Coletta. You're listening to Smart City. I'm Carol Coletta. The road to riches rides differently for everyone, and no one knows that better than my next guest, Randall Jones. Randall is the founder of Worth Magazine and the author of a new book called The Richest Man in Town. In it, he has conversations with 100 of the wealthiest Americans about their wealth and how they define success. Randall, what was it about this topic of the richest man in town that first hooked you?
Well, I've always been fascinated by the rich, but more interested in the self-made rich, those people who, by dint of their own creativity and drive and grit and determination, seem to somehow reach the American dream. But more than that, I wanted to paint a truly honest, representative, and geographic portrait of wealth in America. So often I think we view the worlds of wealth and success through the lenses of either Wall Street or Hollywood, and we forget this vast country in between where great success is taking place, businesses are being built, and consequently, people are getting awfully rich.
Well, what is rich in your term?
Well, in The Richest Man in Town, rich is $100 million rich. That's the poorest one of the 100 individuals that I interviewed for the book, because I went to 100 towns from sort of New York to Natchez and everything in between. And the median net worth was $1 billion. But as I said, the poorest one on the list was $100 million. So that's richest man in town rich. My personal definition of rich would be something that's much more personal, meaning you have to think about what it is that you want out of life. And what I want and what I think most people want is enough money to live a rich and full life and to have a sense of freedom in their lives, to do the things that most matter to them.
Name some of the people you talked with for your book.
Well, in Chicago, Sam Zell was my richest self-made man. In New York, it was Carl Icahn. Seattle, it was Bill Gates. But those were the ones that were, frankly, the least interesting to me. I was much more interested in Alan Jones in Cleveland, Tennessee, the guy who started Checks by Cash, or Hartley Peavy in Meridian, Mississippi, who started Peavy Electronics and now is worth $500 million, or Roxanne Quimby in Portland, Maine, who founded Burt's Bees. These people who may not be famous by any stretch of the imagination, but have achieved the American dream or have achieved such financial success that I was very intrigued and interested in how they did it. And then from a sociological standpoint, I was interested in, you know, what are the real commonalities of these richest men or richest women in town? You know, every town has one, a great American success story. And I think what was gratifying to me was the fact that every town does have one. Therefore, this book did prove that the American dream is still alive and well and attainable, even in these turbulent economic times.
Did you find people, did you talk with people who happened to be the richest man or woman in town, but the town around them was in decline?
I can't say that I saw a town that was in decline. I had a very difficult time interviewing the richest man in Detroit. He was not well at the time, William Davidson, and he subsequently died. Detroit, clearly, at the time I was writing the book, was in decline and is in decline. And there are those who argue it's been in decline for several decades. Having lived there personally myself in the 80s, I don't see it as a perpetual downward slope. I see it much more as an electrocardiogram. It's a town that has highs when the automotive industry is really doing well, and it has lows when it is not. So obviously, the town is in decline right now. Having said that, Mr. Davidson had been an extraordinary philanthropist and giver to that town. So in many ways, through his gifts and his philanthropy, he changed the landscape of that town.
Well, the richest man in town or the richest woman in town would likely also be one of the busiest. So how did you get these interviews?
That's the best question yet. That was the hardest part of doing The Richest Man in Town. Someone said to me the other day, how long did it take you to write it? I said, 4 months. Lassoing these individuals and getting the interviews was over 2 years of my life. And often, even after they agreed to be interviewed, they would say, Randy, you've got a half an hour. Of course, I would get there, and 4 hours later, we were still talking about their lives and their success philosophies and what they had actually accomplished. But amazingly to me, most of these richest men in town or richest women in town had not ever been terribly retrospective. They're such doers, such forward thinkers, such busy people, as you intimate, that they spend very little time looking back over their lives and thinking about what they've accomplished. So in many cases, it was actually kind of fun for them to go through that exercise.
Did you interview them all in person?
Not all of them in person. I would say about 70% were in person and about 30% were over the phone.
I ask because I was wondering if when you walk into their offices, is there anything that they have in common? Do they have family pictures? Do they have awards they've won? I mean, did you see anything that in common in the 70% of the offices you visited?
Well, in some cases it was their offices, in some cases it was their homes, and I did notice some commonalities. Number one, their offices were not overly grand, even though, as I said, the poorest one among them was worth $100 million. They were nice, normal offices, family pictures strewn around. It's why I call these people, keep in mind, these were all the richest self-made men or women in their towns. There might be someone who's actually richer because of inheritance, but because they were self-made, they're what I call the rooted or the responsible rich. And the hardest thing for me, Carol, as a journalist, was to be totally dispassionate, because I found myself really liking, not all of them, but the vast majority of these people, because they often were one of the largest employers in town. They seemed to care deeply about that town, and they gave to that town, and therefore they did, as I said earlier, they changed the very landscape of those towns, and they tended to be, in most cases, highly respected by the citizens of their town.
So what did you think the richest man in town, 100 of them, might have to teach the rest of us?
Well, exactly 12 things and a whole lot more. The subtitle of the book is The 12 Commandments of Wealth. And what this really is the 12 common themes that I saw among all of these individuals. Now, obviously, there are more, and there are lifestyle traits that I write about in the book as well. But it starts with commandment number one, seek money for money's sake, and ye shall not find. Meaning that I kept hearing Carol over and over again, Randy, it was never about the money. I never set out to be the richest man in town or be the most successful person in town. I simply wanted to own my own company, build my own business, and as a result of that, have the freedom to do the things that I want to do in the way in which I want to do them. So at first I said, you know, it's easy to say it's not about the money as you sit atop $100 million or more of net worth. But the more I heard it, the more I really did believe these individuals that money was simply the natural byproduct of their efforts and the success that they enjoyed from building a company in most cases in their towns. Because as Phil Ruffin, the richest man in Wichita, said to me, you don't get rich working for someone else. So all of these great American wealth creators loved being in control of their own destiny, and that usually meant starting, building, and running their own companies.
And obviously we don't have time to talk about all 12 commandments, but tell me about two or three of them that stand out for you.
Maybe the most startling one to me was they don't set goals. I mean, here they are.
Oh, my God. No to-do list, no goals. I'm shattered.
To-do list, yes, but not these overly grandiose, you know, five-year plans or long-range goals. They're what I call executors, and I don't mean off-with-your-head executions. I mean that they are really good at focusing on the things that matter that day. It's almost like the Japanese principle of Kaizen, small, daily, incremental improvements. Charlie Cawley, the richest man in Wilmington, Delaware, said, "Life by the inch is a cinch. Life by the yard is hard." So they did not look very far down the road. They were looking at the things that mattered most each day and trying every day, every week, every month to do better than the previous period. And I found that fascinating, because how many books are there out there on goal setting? And how many times have we been told by our parents it's critical to set your goals? Well, these guys and women did not.
Did you find them to be uniformly good communicators?
Yes, I did. Amazingly good communicators. That's not to say that they sound like you on the radio. It's not to say that they might not get a little nervous and have butterflies when they stand and deliver before an audience. But they are consummate salespeople. That was one commonality. They love to evangelize their company, their product, their service, or their charity. And that meant that they had to be rather good communicators. And it became a sort of natural thing for most of them, because it was something they felt so passionate about and cared about so deeply.
You talked to such an interesting array of people. I happen to know a few people on your list. Were there a couple of interviews that stood out for you?
You know, that's like asking me which of my three sons I love the most.
Yeah, but I know. But there must have been interviews. There must have been people who were, for whatever reason, more memorable.
Yes, there were. I think of Jim Olschlager, the richest man in Akron, Ohio. Maybe one of the most inspirational interviews I had. He runs the $30 billion Oak Investment Fund that he started now almost 30 years ago after having been a corporate guy at Firestone Tire and Rubber. He had MS and was diagnosed about the time he started his company, and yet he's continued to build it. He's totally wheelchair bound, but yet he's running a $30 billion company and has the most extraordinary attitude about life I have ever seen. He says, don't treat me like a victim, and I encourage all MS people to not allow themselves to be treated like a victim. He has to have help to do almost everything physically, but his mind is so incredibly fertile and quick that I loved being around him. And I thought, boy, he thinks he's living the American dream. And yet for most of us, we would look at him and say, other than having $700 million and a very successful company, your life must be very difficult. And he doesn't look at it that way at all. And then there's Hartley Peavy in Meridian, Mississippi, who wanted more than anything to be the next Bo Diddley. He wanted to be a great guitar player, you know, and he realized he had what he calls an intervention with himself early on, and he realized that he was never going to be the greatest guitar player, but he realized that he was pretty good at building things. So he started building amplifiers to make the better guitar player sound even better. And consequently, he's built a $500 million fortune in the process. And he's got more Mississippi Maxims than Carter has liver pills, you know. And he said to me, I said, "What's your biggest advice to anybody who's trying to reach the American dream?" He said, "Three words, Randy: focus, focus, focus. If you chase two rabbits, both will get away." And there was just sort of one of those after the next. So he was a very memorable character, and also wonderfully motivating, I thought.
I love that. You just mentioned the American dream. You include a chapter in your book on the American dream, and that's a topic that I've been thinking about lately. How would you describe the American dream as it was expressed by the richest men in town that you spoke with?
The number one word that I kept hearing when I asked that question, "How do you define the American dream, Mr. Richest Man or Richest Woman in Town?" And it was freedom. Yeah, freedom to do the things you want to do. It was not having, you know, the big house or the Bentley. These people were not, you know, like the millionaire next door who got to be a millionaire by being penurious and never spending any money. These people lived well and enjoyed their money and their lives. But it was not about the things. It was not about while many of them did have boats and yachts, that didn't seem to be the thing that meant the most to them. The freedom to pursue their business, the freedom to live the kind of life on their terms that they wanted to live was the American dream to them. And I would say that makes a lot of sense, because that's certainly my American dream.
Yeah, well, I agree with you. I do think that is at the heart of what we think of as American. But do you think that dream is in flux? Is the American dream changing?
I think the American dream has been challenged of recent. But I do not believe it has been dealt a death blow by any stretch of the imagination. And the richest man in town really proves that. It proves that businesses are still being built. They are growing. They are employing people all across this country. Yes, it's been a very challenging period. And I would say some of the people who are not a part of this book, you know, the Bernie Madoffs of the world, made things very difficult for a lot of us. The big banks made some decisions that made things very difficult for a lot of us. Having said that, we've all lived through tough economic times. All of these richest men and women in town told me so much about their failures or the tough times in their lives. They wouldn't take anything for that. So I'm trying to think of this as a period that's like many of those down periods where they've lived through and come out the other end doing extraordinarily well.
But I wonder where the difference lies. I mean, freedom to do the things you want to do makes perfect sense. Live life on their own terms. Clearly, some of us took too much freedom. I mean, in that we mortgaged ourselves to the hilt and we ran up the credit cards. We were doing what we wanted to do, but we were doing it without the underpinning to do it. And so I'm wondering sort of what you felt in these interviews from these guys and women that communicated, I guess, that sense of where those boundaries are.
Well, I heard time and time again, you know, that you have to loathe leverage. Most of these people still own their own companies. And they do that because they did not want the banks to own the company. Therefore, they didn't leverage themselves significantly. They didn't really like taking their companies public, even though 30 of them have at some point. But there were five of these richest men in town who took their companies public only to buy it back a few years later because they did not like giving up that control or having that many bosses, or for that matter, having someone determine how much of the company they leverage.
Although Fred Smith, for instance, who is one of the people you include in your interviews from Memphis, his company is certainly public, and there are others on your list that are in that same category, although I'm sure he still owns a huge chunk of the FedEx stock. I mean, it's a global company now, and it's a public company. So, and he still runs it in, he's a great risk taker, but also very conservative in many ways. And
oh, absolutely. He's a brilliant businessman, and he's not unlike the 29 others who either founded or still run one of the 30 publicly traded companies that are a part of the book. And I actually look at those 30 companies in the RMIT index, just like the Dow Jones index. And you could do a whole lot worse than investing with the richest man in town, because those 30 stocks that are represented by the richest men in town are up year to date over 38%. So it shows that they're pretty smart about how they run their businesses, even in very, very difficult times. And they are not immune to the economy by any stretch of the imagination. FedEx, as you mentioned, has had a tough time, and its stock has actually been a little up and down over the last year as demand has decreased. But Green Mountain Coffee Roasters is up 128% year to date. The richest man in Burlington, Vermont, Bob Stiller. So people are still drinking coffee, and they're drinking his because it's, you know, it's the quality almost of a Starbucks that you can have single serve in your home.
Sure. What do you think would happen if these guys lost their money? If all of a sudden they weren't the richest men in town, would they be fundamentally different people?
I don't think so, because the vast majority of them, Carol, did at some point, and often more than one time, lose their money and lose everything. There's several examples. Bruton Smith, the richest man in Charlotte, North Carolina, you know, went bankrupt early on in his life. So it's sort of from bankruptcy to billionaire. And that's one of the great commonalities of these great American wealth creators is resilience. They do not fear failure. They don't enjoy it, but they don't fear it. And they know that if you haven't gone through tough economic times and tough financial situations, and in fact, life challenges, you probably haven't lived life to the fullest.
Randall, it was a pleasure talking with you. Thanks so much for being our guest on Smart City.
Carol, it was my great pleasure. Thank you.
Randall Jones is the founder of Worth Magazine and author of the book, The Richest Man in Town, The 12 Commandments of Wealth. Finally this week, Walker Smith is looking on the sunny side of life. Our City Views commentator brings us a historic perspective on optimism.
For all the angst and anxiety we feel these days, there is an undercurrent of optimism that continues to inspire us, but which we often overlook. In conjunction with its 30th anniversary show earlier this year, CBS Sunday Morning did a poll that repeated questions that had originally been asked of people in 1979. One of these was the question of whether people believed that our lives will be better in the future. In other words, a question about how optimistic people feel about things improving in the years to come. Now, in 1979, only 46% agreed with that. In other words, the majority, 54%, did not agree that people's lives would be better in the future. The majority felt pessimistic about our future prospects. No surprise, really. The 1970s were, I'm sorry to say, awful. These were dreadful times. The decade was racked by inflation and bookended by two severe 16-month recessions that are two of the longest and worst recessions since the Great Depression of the 1930s. The 1970s also began and ended with oil crises and shortages of fuel oil and natural gas. 1978 was one of the coldest winters on record. 1979 opened with sirens at Three Mile Island, followed by Soviets in Afghanistan and hostages in Iran. Interest rates and unemployment hit double digits. The mood was aptly encapsulated in the title of that year's blockbuster new movie, Francis Ford Coppola's Apocalypse Now. No wonder most of us felt pessimistic about the future. In fact, President Jimmy Carter's own poll showed the same pessimism measured then by CBS. More people felt that the future would be worse than the past, not better. And this prompted his July 15, 1979 National Malaise speech, in which he scolded us to prepare for a coming, quote-unquote, age of limits. I mention this just to put today's angst and anxiety in some context. Things are bad today, no question about it. I'm not suggesting otherwise, but lest we forget, we actually felt worse back then than we do today. When CBS polled people this year about whether people's lives would be better in the future, 61% agreed. In other words, today, in contrast to 1979, the vast majority of us are optimistic, not pessimistic. Our mood these days is bad, but we have an enduring belief in the future that is stronger than ever. And I think we should take heart in this. Indeed, we are already seeing a change in the tone of voice we use to talk to one another. Pepsi introduced its Optimism marketing campaign between Christmas and New Year's and has changed its red, white, and blue logo so that the white line forms a smile or a laugh or a grin. Coke followed in January with its Open Happiness campaign, emphasizing a small moment of joy even in the midst of all the bad things around us. Dunkin' Donuts recently launched its You Can Do It campaign, which celebrates the ability of ordinary Americans to overcome extraordinary odds to get things done. And one of the greatest marketing campaigns of all time was last year's presidential campaign by Barack Obama that revolved around the optimistic slogan, "Yes, we can." Yes, indeed we can, and we will. The nationally renowned design firm Cooper Carry launched a website earlier this year that I recommend to everyone. It's called reasonsforoptimism.com. Reasonsforoptimism.com. Each week, they scan the news for all the good, positive, optimistic news that is being ignored in today's climate of media fear-mongering, and they post it there as that week's Reasons for Optimism. They'll even email you a weekly update if you'd like. And they do it because, as they say on their site, it's easy to forget in today's not-so-optimistic world that real progress continues, beauty appears, brave new worlds are explored, and creativity flows. There is still reason for optimism. Don't forget it. Keep believing, just as you do. For City Views, this is Walker Smith.
Walker Smith is president of the Yankelovich Monitor, a trend service of the Futures Company. He joins us from Georgia Public Radio in Atlanta. That's all for this week's show, but if you want more Smart City, go to our website, smartcityradio.com. You can listen to archive shows, read my blog, or sign up for our weekly newsletter. You can also get in touch with us by clicking on the contact button or sending an email to questions@smartcityradio.com. Smart City's web content and audio archive are supported by CEOs for Cities. National distribution is made possible by the Hyde Family Foundations, investing in programs that generate lasting change to improve the future of Memphis, Tennessee, and its citizens. For more information, visit hydefoundations.org. Scotty Iseri is our westward-bound producer and engineer. He's headed to Portland. I'm Carol Coletta.